Well, it's very lovely to be here. It's just by chance that I am giving the first talk, actually. I happen to be free. So I've been asked to give a personal talk about my life and practice, and I've been ordained for quite a long time. I've lived a reasonable time, so I can't possibly tell you everything. I can only sort of select certain things from my life and practice. So what comes is what I thought of yesterday and today. But I'll give you a little bit of background information. So I'm one of those people known as a baby boomer. So I was born just after the Second World War. And so that means that I became a teenager and young adult in the 60s. Now I know if you didn't live in the 60s, you're probably bored to death of people of my age talking about that decade. But anyway, I'm going to say a little bit about it because it was the era into which I arrived as a teenager, as a young adult. So I think, quick look at social history. Second World War, then the 50s, people trying to get back to normal, recover from the war, rebuild, have a normal life, etc., etc. But then somehow in the 60s, this sort of explosion of creativity. I think there was more money around, there were more jobs, and people were just very, very creative in all kinds of different fields, experimenting with theatre, music, film, all kinds of weird and wacky alternative therapies. People engaged in left-wing politics, sometimes quite extreme left-wing politics. People inspired by spirituality, people going off to the East and coming back, having been in ashrams and all kinds of places. Eastern teachers coming west. People got experimenting with alternative lifestyles, living in communes, free love, and of course mind-altering substances were in the mix. So it's a very kind of heady mix, and into that mix I was living in London, I graduated and joined that kind of, we used to call it the underground or the counterculture. So I was part of that. Before that I'd been to Imperial College of Science and Technology and studied as a scientist, and in a way I was a scientific materialist and a militant atheist. But then I discovered mind-altering substances, and that kind of opened my mind up to the possibilities of consciousness, that consciousness was more than just materialism. And I got very interested in mysticism and Eastern religions, which was all kind of floating around at the time. And I read quite a lot of books and on all kinds of wacky things, including the Aetherius Society that believed that there were flying saucers and we'd come from flying saucers. I read everything in that kind of ilk. But I was very, very struck by Buddhism. That was what attracted me most of the things that I explored through reading. And I think it was because it was non-theistic, and I had it with judgmental creator God, no thank you. So it was non-theistic, it didn't have that kind of belief system at all. It had a very clear spiritual path, and I kind of knew somewhere that I needed to know what to do, or I needed to do something. And it was also, particularly Tibetan Buddhism, which was what I read about first, was deeply imbued with myth and symbol and archetype, and I'd read quite a lot of Jung, so that also really spoke to me. And I knew I needed to learn to meditate. I knew I needed to do something, partly because I wasn't in very good mental and emotional states. I was quite unhappy. I was quite depressed. And after a while, reading just wasn't enough. So I tried various things, and none of it really worked for me. And then I took up Hatha Yoga, discovered yoga, which actually was very good because I wasn't very embodied. I wasn't very in touch with my body, and that really helped. And through the woman who ran the yoga class, I got onto my first FWO retreat in the spring Easter of 1970. So I'm 24. So that was my first contact, going off on that retreat, a big open retreat, kind of retreats you've probably been on as well. And there were lots of people my age there with similar interests, similar types of people. But there were people of all ages. It was a big mix of people. And it was very, very pleasant. It was very, very friendly, very open, very encouraging. So that was great. And I learnt to meditate on the first day I was there. And I thought, yes, this is really for me, this is really going to work for me, this is really going to help me. I must have learnt the mindfulness of reading and the metta-bhava. And the second day on the retreat, this man turned up, who turned out to be Sangharakshita. So he'd been in America teaching, and he'd sort of come from there to the retreat. So he just turned up in the lounge that afternoon, and he was very friendly with the people he knew, and I was really fascinated by him because I knew what a Theravadan bhikkhu was supposed to look like, and he didn't. First of all, he was English, that was obvious. He was wearing orange robes, but they were pretty grubby. He was wearing a polo neck jumper and slippers. Well, it was Easter, it was cold, it was snowing. but he had very, very long hair. Some of you have probably seen photographs of Sangharakshita in that phase of his life. His long hair and great big sideburns and not very good teeth and glasses. And so he was a bit, oh, a Tibetan mala. So he was a bit of a mix. He didn't quite fit the boxes, as it were. And he was talking about, to the people he knew in the room, that before he'd come back from America, he'd been to a hippie commune in the States, and he'd sat up all night and watched a total eclipse of the moon. And I thought, this is a cool guy. He's quite cool, isn't he? He was about 45, so middle-aged, but in the prime of life, but he was a lot of energy. So that evening, we were played a tape lecture. I've told this story before, but I'll tell it again. We were played a tape lecture from the Eightfold Path series on a reel-to-reel tape recorder. This is a very, very long time ago. The iPod had not even been dreamt of. And he came and sat next to the tape recorder on a chair. So he listened to his own talk, which I guess was sensible, really, pragmatic. You know, it was already on tape. Why not listen to it? Why give a new talk? But he laughed at his own jokes, which I thought was really quite endearing. He's got a very good sense of humour. But it had, the whole evening, had a very, very strong effect on me, because what was coming out of the tape recorder, which was his voice, of course, his master's voice, what was coming out of the tape recorder from the Eightfold Path, I can't remember which lecture it was, but it just made such sense to me. It was very, very, in some ways it was very direct and simple and straightforward Dharma. And some of the things I tried to read were pretty incomprehensible. So that was, you know, it kind of communicated very straightforwardly to me. On the other hand, I knew it was very, very profound. It had both those kind of levels. And I felt, I suppose I resonated with what I was hearing very, very strongly, very, very deeply. I almost felt as though I knew what he was going to say before he said it, which of course I didn't. But I think that's just a feeling of how strongly it kind of impacted on me. So I felt I was receiving the truth, the Dharma's truth. You know, it was a kind of hotline to the Dharma's truth through the tape recorder and through Sangharakshita, who was sitting next to the tape recorder. So had a very, very strong impact. I don't think I've been the same since. And I think that initial experience of kind of meeting the Dharma with that kind of force has been, you know, a fundamental experience from then on, really. And a sort of bottom line that, you know, life goes up and down, doesn't it? Life chucks all sorts of things at you, inner and outer, and you know, sometimes my life's been quite difficult, but that experience is kind of there. You know, I can sort of tap into it, and in my relationship with Sangharakshita. So he went back to the States, and then later he came back to England, and I just was captivated, I guess, and I went to everything I could. There was a little centre in central London, and he taught meditation classes. After the meditation, he'd take questions and answers. He gave lectures, he led retreats, and I just went to everything that I possibly could. I made notes because I might forget what I want to say, even though it's my life I'm talking about. So, yeah, I was very, very involved and made friends with people coming along who are still my friends today, all these years later. And I realised at some point that he did a lot of things himself. You know, he organised all the talks and the classes, and sometimes he made the tea. And I thought, oh, you know, he needs a bit of help. So some of us started to help out. And then that was a way of making, you know, more personal connection with him. So a few years later, we needed the new centre. That centre came to an end. And we found a centre in North London, in Archway, a rented centre. And it was in a redevelopment area in Camden. So there was lots of empty houses, empty terraced houses in that area, because Camden Council ran out of money and they couldn't finish the project. So lots of us, a lot of young people involved in the movement and with Bante at this period, about 1972, we decided to move into those houses as squatters. And I think in that centre was there for about 5 years, and I think in its heyday there were probably 6 or 7 or even 8 communities in the few streets around that centre, with about 5 or 6 people living in them, all of us in our 20s. So there was a lot of people living together, experimenting with communal living, you know, living close to other people involved in the centre. Some people trying to start businesses, selling Whole Foods in market stalls, and yeah, very, very vibrant, very inspired time. So I think we were sort of still quite early in the history of the order. So the movement was founded in 67, the order in 68, this is 72, it's not very long. So I think we really felt we were co-creating, with Sangharakshita's guidance, something really, really new, a new community, a new society, a new world, you know, useful idealism. Wonderful thing, useful idealism. It kind of tempers as you get older, but let's not knock useful idealism. So yeah, we felt very, very inspired and very committed to what we were doing. And Sangharakshita had, you know, he'd done a lot of teaching, meditation classes, retreats, lots of lecture series. And around this time, having kind of gathered a bunch of people who were obviously inspired and keen, going to stick around for a while, he started to teach in seminar form. So he'd take a text, take a small group of people, smallish group of people, go off on retreat and unpack that text in kind of dialogue with people. So all kinds of issues arose. Issues that were relevant at the time and issues that are still relevant now. And all that material is available on Free Buddhist Audio in transcript form. So the first text that he took was the Bodhicharyavatara, a text entering the path of enlightenment by an Indian poet called Shantideva, from which our Sevenfold Puja comes. I'm sure if you go to Bodhilila's course, she'll tell you all about that. So it's a text about the life of the Bodhisattva. And the Bodhisattva is a person who dedicates their life for enlightenment for all sentient beings. It's totally inclusive. No one's left out. And in that dedication, the Bodhisattva gives birth to what we call the Bodhicitta, so the will to enlightenment. Something that's quite hard to describe because it's a sort of transcendental force. If you've been listening to Subhuti, it would be in the Dharma Niyama processes that he's been talking about. Sangharakshita is described as the will to enlightenment, or a non-egoic stream of spiritual energy, you know, let loose for the good of the world, a kind of synthesis of great wisdom and great compassion. So that's what the Bodhisattva experiences. It's a very, very inspiring ideal in the history of Buddhism. But in that seminar, Sangharakshita says, it's quite a small passage, but I think it had an enormous effect on those of us around at the time. He says that that non-egoic stream of spiritual energy, or the bodhicitta, is more likely to arise, rather than an individual, which is how the tradition often talks about it, it's more likely to arise when a group of people, a number of people, engage intensively together. Living in community, working together in a team together, coming to a class together, practicing together, doing sevenfold puja together, just coming together. And I think the principle is that you put yourself wholeheartedly into whatever that situation is, and everyone else does the same, and you create something that is greater than the sum of its parts. It's just something else, something other, that you could call bodhicitta. So that was very inspiring to us, because we were already kind of doing a lot of stuff together very intensively. And it's around this time that he also talked about the 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara being the symbol, the archetypal symbol for the movement and the order, with the sense that the body of Avalokiteshvara is this figure, the body, 11 heads and 1,000 arms that some of you have seen. The body is the body of the spiritual community. We're all kind of in harmony together. And through that, everyone manages to express their particular gifts in the hands into the world. So yeah, it's a very exciting, inspiring, intense time. So yes, I lived in that sort of situation for several years. And in that time, I got ordained. So I got ordained, as Shubha said, in 1973. So quite a short time after I got involved, just over 3 years. And Sangharakshita had, meanwhile, he'd gone off on a sabbatical to a cliff top hut in Cornwall and left this group of young people and said, "You run the centre." Which I think is marvellous that he, you know, he had that sort of confidence and he wanted us to sort of step up and take responsibility, I guess. So off he went. So he came back for my ordination and the other people I was ordained with. And I remember my private ordination still very vividly. It's a long time ago, but I still remember it very vividly. I remember leaving the main shrine room and going off to another smaller shrine room where Sangharakshita was. I don't remember much about the shrine. I just remember sitting opposite him and that being a very strong experience and the room seeming to be filled with light. And in a private ordination ceremony, you're given a new name. So he said to me, "I'm going to call you Dharmadina." And he looked at me as though I would recognise the name. And I looked completely blank. And he said, "Oh, she's one of the enlightened female disciples of the Buddha." And he said, "Well, she is on page 25 of the Survey of Buddhism." So I still didn't, I kind of smiled. And then I later discovered that at some point before the ordinations, he'd met with the existing order members and they talked about the qualities of the people he was about to ordain. So he said about me, "Oh, she has really good Dharma knowledge." And that was because he'd run a class or a little group for people who wanted to be ordained, a study group, and previously. And I think we were a bit blocked with him. So one day he came along and said, "I'm going to give you a Dharma quiz." And I was the Hermione Granger of my generation. I knew all the answers. I was top girl. And study wasn't very cool in those days. It was all about meditation and practicing meditation. So when we came downstairs from the group, other people said to me, "Well, you've been studying as I was going." The worst possible thing. I hadn't really been studying. I just listened to a lot of Bhante's tapes and talks, and they just affected me very deeply. And I had a very, very good memory in those days. So I kind of remembered it. So I wasn't really that much of a swot. And then in that discussion, when he said, "Oh, she's got good Dharma knowledge," someone else said, "It's completely untrue, and she's read the Survey of Buddhism twice," which I hadn't read it at all. So I had to go off after my ordination. I was going on holiday with the Survey of Buddhism under my arm and find out who Dharmadina was. So I like the name. I think it's a lovely sound. And actually, to begin with, I thought, "Oh, giver of the Dharma, it sounds a bit academic or something." And I felt I really rejected academia. I didn't want to be a scientist. I hadn't enjoyed my university 3 years, so I kind of didn't know anything to do with that. But I guess it was about studying something else. It was about studying something that I really loved and then hopefully teaching it. So I do very much like my name. And also, in the private ordination ceremony, I asked for the visualization practice of green Tara. So I knew I wanted that practice, and I remember Sangharakshita saying, "Oh, no hesitation there then," because he would say, "What practice would you like?" And I said, so I had wondered about, I had been drawn to Manjigosha as a practice, as a wisdom bodhisattva, but I knew that I really needed to contemplate a figure, a compassion figure. And that was partly because I had such a lot of difficulty facing dukkha or suffering. Other people's suffering, my own suffering. I wanted to respond, but I just get overwhelmed by the scale of suffering. And I didn't understand what would happen to me then, but later on I discovered the term horrified anxiety. So I think I would fall into horrified anxiety or panic about the kind of extent of suffering in the world. And or I'd just fall into despair. So I'd want to do something and then I just, you know, not get out of bed and not do anything. So I thought, well, I needed a compassion figure to contemplate, to sort of help me be stronger and be able to face dukkha. And I'd spent some time at the Ariatara. It's now a community, but it used to be a centre in Purley. And there's a beautiful wall painting of Green Tara on the wall that Devaraja painted back then. And it's still my favourite image of Green Tara. So I'd seen this image and thought, how beautiful. So I love the figure, and she's very, very beautiful. She's green, so she's about nature and healing. And she steps down with the right leg, so she steps into the world, and that's what I found so difficult. And she steps with this hand in generosity. But she's the other leg, the left leg, is in meditation. So I think I didn't have that kind of balance. I kind of go into things and then kind of be overwhelmed. Where she sits with this incredible poise and wisdom. So it's wisdom and compassion. The compassion comes out as a wisdom, and the generosity comes out as a wisdom. And this hand is in giving the three jewels. So those are the three jewels. Sometimes seen as a fearlessness mudra, so also very strong, fearless. So she's sometimes called the quick one, the heroine, the fearless one. She's also referred to as the quintessence of compassion, so there's that kind of delicacy. She's said to be very, very forgiving, which was very important to me. And she's born from the tears of Avalokiteshvara, the great Bodhisattva of compassion. So there's some wonderful and beautiful imagery around her that really spoke to me. And she holds, in her hand, she holds lotuses, but they're not lotuses that grow out of the mud. They're quite magical blue night lotuses. They grow in the mountains and they only open in the moonlight. So it's a beautiful symbolism that really appealed to me. So that was the practice that I took, and that, yeah, I've done many, many years, daily for many, many, many years, not so much recently. So there I was ordained, living in that, around that centre with all those other people. We're all of us in our 20s, like idealism. And I became the first supported member of the community. I was the secretary of the council of that centre. I was asked to do that. So organising things at the centre. And I lived on the princely sum of £3 a week, which went quite a bit further in those days than it does now. So I did that for quite a while, a couple of years. And then a couple of years after that, the movement was growing. So there were other centres in the UK, other centres in Europe. And Bhante asked me if I would work with him for the women in the movement. So, you know, to kind of, he couldn't see everybody all the time and he couldn't lead all the retreats. So he asked me if we, you know, I would work for him, as it were, with him, and become Mitra Convener for not just the centre, but for the UK and Europe. So that meant that I tried to make sure that women mitras in the movement, people who asked for ordination, had resources that they needed wherever they were, that they had study, that if they had living situations, if we could organise that they had local retreats and national retreats. So that was, I did that for quite a long time, about 7 years, I think. And that was, I was very inspired to do that, and that went very well for the first few years, but it meant for me a lot of travelling. So although I lived in communities, I wasn't there very much, so in a way I didn't have much of a base. And I was kind of doing a lot of these things on my own, as it were, out there on my own. And in that time also moved several times, moved house several times. I remember coming back from one visit to somewhere and coming back to my community and thinking, it looks a bit empty. And then realising that everybody moved out. I mean, they left me a note, but I didn't see the note. The house was coming to an end. I lived in short life properties for a long time and they'd moved in the next street and, you know, they were there with all my stuff. But that happened a couple of times. You go away and come back and... So, yeah, there wasn't always a base to work from, as it were. And it was quite a lot of responsibility, and I'm still reasonably young, taking a lot of responsibility. And responsibility is a bit of a theme in my life, sort of taking responsibility and then getting a bit overwhelmed by responsibility and not handling responsibility in a totally creative way, not taking myself into account, you know, all those kind of things. So that began to kind of happen, I guess. So I'll come back to, I'll just say a little bit more and then I'll come back more to that. So outwardly, very full life from my early days in the movement, a lot happening, doing a lot of responsibility, great, very inspiring, a lot of travelling, a lot of teaching. But in more inner life in that time, yes, I came along to the movement not a very integrated or very happy person for things, because of things that happened in my life before that and my conditioning in my childhood. And I was idealistic and inspired on one hand, but I could easily fall into depression, horrified anxiety, despair on the other hand. So I get tripped up by that. I kind of go off and do something and then, something would get triggered and I'd be in very confused and confusing and painful mental and emotional states. I didn't really understand. And I think, the latter part of that project, not having, being out on my own, having a lot of responsibility, not having a base, didn't really help that. I wasn't very good at looking after myself. I didn't have terribly good health, and I wasn't very good with boundaries. So it's a lovely mix. And I also suffered from a strong inner critic, that, critical inner voice that tells you you're not really up to much. I had one of those. So that, was part of having self-doubt and a lot of irrational guilt. So really, delightful package of sangskaras. They weren't there all the time. When they kind of arose, it was a very strong experience, and it would kind of derail me, I guess. So I think it was the early 80s. I was going on a seminar, Sangharakshita, and I was around. I'd come to a meeting here. That's right, the LBC. And somebody said something to me. It was critical. And looking back, I can think, why didn't I just say, that's not true, that's really stupid. But actually, I didn't receive it like that because I already had a strong inner critic. And it was a guy who said it, and that didn't really help. And I felt really, really devastated. I remember wandering the streets of Bethnal Green after that meeting, feeling really kind of miserable, and maybe I should leave the order, and obviously wasn't up to it and everything. But luckily, I was going on a seminar the next day, which Banti was teaching. So I mulled this over for the week I was there, and at the end of the seminar I went to see him. Everybody saw him for about an hour or so. And I said to him, this is what's happened. I don't want you to decide who's right or who's wrong. I don't want you to referee. I don't want that. I want you to tell me why I react so strongly. So that was a good question. Didn't have sort of blame in it. And he knew me very well. I'd always been very open with him, very honest with him. I'd written to him lots when he wasn't in London. So I don't think there was much he didn't know about me. And I've told this story before, but it's quite a kind of pivotal story in my life and my relationship with him. He kind of looked at me and said, well, you have lots of self-doubt. And it sounds maybe a bit odd, but it was a bit like, oh, that's what it is. It was kind of named and objectified, diagnosed, as I suppose my experience was just the mess with me. I didn't really know what was going on. So it was like, oh. And I said, well, what do I do about that? And he said, you need lots of unconditional love. Whereupon I burst into tears, thinking, I can't have that. If you're in that state, you don't think you can have unconditional love. So he gave me his hanky, and he was very, very kind and very, very encouraging. And he said, you need encouragement. You need to go back and tell those people that you need encouragement. I said, I'm not going to go and do that. But anyway, I guess the message got through somewhere. I think that person apologised and so on. But in a way, it was my issue, the fact that I responded so strongly. So in a way, there was a kind of, I had something to get hold of. I understood what was going on and that I really needed to work on those sangskaras. And there's a wonderful aphorism of Sangharakshita's that I found very helpful, where he says, faith is innate, doubt is acquired. Very, very positive statement, isn't it? It's like, well, as a human being, faith is kind of part of our nature. You need faith to kind of get out of bed in the morning, don't you, in a sort of lower level. And doubt, especially that critical self-doubt and irrational guilt and so on, is something you've acquired through your conditioning. So if you've acquired it, you can change it. You can get rid of it, as it were, or transform it is a better word, isn't it? So yeah, so I had quite a lot to work with, and while I was still overall Women's Mitch convener, my dad died in that period, and my mum found that very, very difficult for a couple of years. And when she was feeling a bit better, I went off to New Zealand as part of that work, but also I just really felt like getting away, going somewhere completely different and having a different experience. I went to work in the centre out there. So I went for 6 months and I stayed for 18 months for various reasons. And in that time, I realised that when I came back to London, that actually I needed to change the way I lived and worked. It wasn't really working for me, and that I needed just to live in one place, to live with people I knew, to live with some friends, and to have a bit more sort of stability and consistency in my life. So when I came back to the centre of the RBC, that's what I decided to do. I needed to have a different phase of my life and not have that big responsibility and hand that on to someone else. So I was here at this centre for 10 years, I think. A very, very good years in my Dharma life. So I lived in community with people who knew me very well, with my friends. I didn't not do anything. I did things around the RBC. I did quite a lot. But I didn't have that big overarching responsibility. I didn't have to travel if I didn't want to. So I had stability and consistency, continuity, ground, you know, all the things that I needed. And an opportunity to just really look at my condition patterns, my samskaras, and kind of really get in there and work with them. With the help of other people, with the help of people I live with, I had fantastic friends who, you know, just really helped me undo those knots. It's a very, very creative period. And in that period, the 10 years I was here, I also realised that I needed to mend my relationship with my mother. It wasn't in very good nick, in a way it never had been. I found her very, very critical of me, and I found that very painful. At some point she said to one of my friends that I'd wasted my life. She was quite strong, because I was a Buddhist. I had no money, didn't own a house, didn't have a husband anymore, didn't have any children, you know. I hadn't really done what she would like me to have done, wasting my education. So she could be very, very critical. On the other hand, she was a widow, she was on her own. I did love her. And I had a kind of ambivalent relationship with her, which, you know, I didn't really want to go and see her so much, and I'd feel guilty. So, yeah, very kind of complicated. And a very good friend of mine, an older Dharmacharini, was staying with me, and she heard the other end of a telephone conversation I was having with my mother. She's pretty direct New Zealander, and she said, "You've got to sort that out." And she was absolutely right. And I said, "Well, how do I do that?" And she said, "Well, you've got to step towards her. You've got to ring her regularly, go and see her regularly. You've got to do the work." So that's what I did. And after a while, she responded. I'm very grateful to her that she did respond. She might not have done. She might have just carried on thinking what she thought. But no, she did respond. And we began to sort of build a relationship, which became an incredibly close and loving relationship as time wore on, particularly in the last years of her life. And I think in the end, she thought I was the bee's knees. She thought I was wonderful. So that changed. Yeah. And also in that period, it was quite a creative period, I decided to go back to university and study. So I went to King's College and did a religious studies and Western philosophy degree, which I really, really loved. I think my first experience of university was quite miserable, so I just wanted to do this, and I really, really enjoyed it. And I really focused on it. So I lived in community and I was involved in some older things, but I didn't do anything around the centre for those 3 years. I thought, well, if I'm going to do this, I might as well do it as fully as possible. And when I graduated, I came back to teach full-time at the London Buddhist Centre. Dharmarashi was chair and he said, "I'll come back and teach meditation." So in a couple of years supported teaching, mainly beginner's meditation, but mitra study and regular class, and quite a lot of outreach in Covent Garden and so on. So that was all great as well. So going back to, you know, the whole of my life in the order, I've spent a lot of time in single-sex situations. You know, I like doing things with the women. I men, that's fine, but I like practicing with other women. So, you know, Dover Women's Mitch Convener, lots of women's retreats, lots of women's communities, and really keen that other women join the order if they wanted to. So I'd been involved in that, but in the time I was at university, I just stepped back from all that. And in that period, Taraloka was founded as a retreat centre. And they began to run some kind of a few ordination training retreats. Not very many, just a month and then a couple of weeks in the year. And the guys had had Padmaloka for a while. They had an ordination course up and running, lots of retreats. They had three-month retreats in Tuscany. They were getting ordained in droves. And the women, it was quite slow. So in 1990, I went on one of those retreats. I'd graduated, and it was a month's retreat and Taraloka. I think there were about 30 of us on the retreat, big team, lots of women. Great retreat, lots of ritual, lots of meditation, lots of study. And I just enjoyed it so much. And a few of us there on the team, I knew them very, very well. I'd lived with them and worked with them in the past. We just thought, we've just got to get a retreat centre together. We've just got to get a course together for women so that, you know, there's a kind of something that has continuity, consistency and follow through for those women. Because women would come on this month's retreat. It was a sort of selection procedure. It was an early X factor. It was awful. You know, come on this retreat and the team would decide, part-time team, who had other things they were doing. These people are ready. They go on to the next retreat. Those people can't. Then those people would go back to their centres, and there'd be, you know, really not a lot of follow-through pastoral care. So it was quite hard a system, really. I mean, it helped people get ordained, but it wasn't really ideal. So that's why we thought, we've really got to do this. So we thought, so let's do it. So youthful idealism can continue into your mid-40s, which is what I was then, I think. So we thought, yeah, let's do it. So we had no property, no money, but a team, and a keen four or five people were keen to do it. So we set about, first of all, fundraising. And we planned that we'd have a couple of years where we freed ourselves up from what we were doing. We would do some of those retreats, and at a certain point we'd move and live together, and we'd start fundraising in earnest and start property searching in earnest. So, you know, it was a kind of, we said let's do it, we had a kind of gradual process. And one of the things I realised was if I was going to do it, it was going to be a responsibility. It was going to need me to be able to commit myself to that project for a decent length of time. And actually, at the time we said we'd do it for life, which was crazy, but anyway. because I think we knew it had to be long term. And I knew that I needed to be really sure that I was integrated enough to do that, and I wasn't going to fall into old habits around responsibility and not look after myself and, you know, be split in that kind of way. I needed to be really sure that it was an integrated decision, both for myself and for the project and for the team and for everybody involved, really. So I did take my time thinking about it, and I talked to people who knew me well. And at one point I was on a long solitary, and, you know, I think solitaries are really interesting in that it was just you and your mental states, and anything that you've been trying to push away, not look at, in your busy life often arises on solitary. So I knew that if there were parts of myself that I'd ignored, who really thought, that's a mad idea, don't do that, you know, they would arise on the solitary retreat. And luckily they didn't, and, you know, it was an integrated decision, and I felt I could move into that project. Yeah, so that was the next, I guess, 15 years of my life. So I can't, you know, I can't tell you all about that, but you know, being involved in a project like that, you know, it's got the beginning, it's got that kind of whole setting up thing, it's got, then it expanded, and then you consolidate, and then you think it's stuck and you have to kind of reform it. So I was there through a lot of those different stages. And I really, really loved being at Tiruvannamalai, and I was in a team, so I wasn't, you know, out on my own, as it were. I was in a team with people. Loads of people got ordained, which is what we wanted. You know, the numbers went up exponentially. It gave that opportunity to lots and lots of people. I felt I was serving the Order in Bante, which is something I've always been very keen to do. was in beautiful surroundings and lots and lots of opportunity for personal practice, meditation, Dharma study. So, you know, what's to worry about? So yeah, very, very good. I mean, you know, there's always going to be difficulties doing something like that in the beginning, you know, the storming of the team and so on. But I think we didn't know each other very well, and I think we worked very creatively on and with each other, which I like. And then in 1996, I became a private preceptor. I ordained several women privately, and that, for me, is just an enormous privilege to sit in a private ordination kuti in the same way that I sat with Sangharakshita, sitting sort of on his behalf, as it were, in his place, open to those dimensions, not really me, as it were, and witnessing someone else making a commitment to the three jewels as part of their entry to the order. It's an absolute privilege to do that. It's not a chore in any sense. So that was part of my life there. And then a couple of years later, I wasn't asked, actually. I was told that I was a public preceptor. Didn't ask people things in those days. So that was a much bigger responsibility, one that I hadn't expected to come my way at all. So it was a bit of a shock. But again, I thought, well, it's what's needed. There was only two women public preceptors. There wasn't anyone at Tiruvannamalai doing that work. And that meant being part of the college and having responsibility for making final decisions about women entering the order in the UK and Europe. So it was a big stretch, but one I was happy to take. But at the same time, almost simultaneously, it's so interesting when I look back, almost simultaneously, I think in the same months, my mother, who at this point was in her, I don't know, 80s, who had a heart condition, lived on her own, suddenly got much worse. So I had two things, two big things, both of which I wanted to do. I wanted to look after her. I'd always said I would look after her when she was older. I wanted to do the other, you know, take on that responsibility and all that involved. So yeah, that was quite interesting 3 years. She lived for 3 years, and you know, she got progressively weaker and sicker, and it took up more of my time, which I was happy to give. But yeah, outwardly, I guess it was sometimes I needed to be in two places at once and I couldn't be. And inwardly, you know, there was a stretch, and I just knew that I needed to somehow, you know, dig deeper into my own resource. I needed to find a place where those two things didn't feel like they were in conflict, even though time-wise sometimes they were, but actually they weren't on another level. And sometimes I could find that space, sometimes I couldn't, and I'd be tired and irritable and whatever, you know, but I did really work at that. And I had fantastic support, and I think I wouldn't have been able to do it without that support from the team at Tiruvannamalai, my other friends, people in the college. So people really wanted me to do what I needed to do in my work. They wanted me to look after my mum, so they would go and look after her for me. She met all kinds of people, just come and, you know, look after her. And by this time she'd mellowed a lot. She was actually really quite sweet and very friendly, and you know, she loved them and they loved her. People would, there'd be a crisis in the middle of the night, or I'd be somewhere else, and you know, people would just drive me to Somerset and, you know, help me. So that was really fantastic, you know, that kind of sense of sangha, which is so important to me, and friendship, which has always been important, but really working at its best, you know, people just kind of giving. I still feel, I mean, it's over 10 years ago, but I still feel incredibly moved by that when I remember it. Something kind of came into being, something incredibly positive, and in a way she was the kind of catalyst for that. So I did, I think, we did our best for her, and I don't have any regrets. I think we did what we could, although I missed her, of course. So I think a kind of outcome of that sort of trying to dig deeper, even though things were quite difficult, was I began to feel, just before she died actually, it was in a way it was quite a difficult year, the year before she died, but I began to feel, how to describe it really, sort of something within that was like springs of clear water, or I had lots of images of mountain streams and springs of clear water and things moving and very, very positive. And I thought, oh, there's a sense of really, really deep contentment that I'm experiencing, even though, you know, outside is all kind of hairy sometimes. And after a while of that happening, I thought, oh, and I think it's also connected with the fact that I'm now single. I've been in a relationship up until a few years before that. And I thought, yes, I'd really like to mark that, and I'd really like to become an anagarika, a brahmacharya, take a vow of celibacy, be very consciously single. But I wasn't sure if I could do that because, you know, to be an anagarika, you sort of not got attachments. I was very attached to my mum when I was living with her, looking after. So I thought, well, maybe it doesn't quite fit. And also, I've got these sort of feelings, and also I've got, you know, sometimes I'm really quite upset and I'm in grief, and, you know, because you almost died several times. So how does that work? And I went to see Bante and told him all this, and he said, well, you know, life isn't always straightforward and you don't always have just one clear set of feelings. And he said that the previous year he'd been on a women's convention, if you're on the conventions, and how happy he was to be there and be with everybody. It's a very, very happy seeing everybody. At the same time, he has quite a big extended family, and one of his grandnephews had died of a drug overdose. So he's also feeling a lot of grief. So he kind of resonated with those feelings, and he said, well, you'll just know when it's the right time, and, you know, if it's now, that would be fine. Don't worry about it. So I took the anagarika precept in the year 2000, and you know, I've not regretted that. For me, it's not so much about not having sex, or it is about that, of course. You can't be anagarika and have sex. It's not so much about that, like a not doing. It's very much to do with a sense of freedom, inner freedom, outer freedom, you know, non-attachment. I have lots of friends, but I just feel I'm single and free and can do what I like. You know, it's about that somehow. So it's a very positive experience for me. Yeah, there's probably lots more I could say about Tiruvannamalai, but time is running out. So, my mother died 2001. So then I was, as it were, free after, you know, a period of kind of grieving. And then a couple of years later, we had a very difficult year in the movement in 2003. Some of you were around, some of you probably weren't, but an order member wrote a letter, a public letter, about his relationship with Bante in the past, sexual relationship about which he wasn't happy. And it's very interesting. Bante was kind of ill. He'd already got ill and he wasn't around. So this letter kind of appeared in our midst, as it were, from him, this guy. And it's hard to kind of quite work out why, but it seemed to act as a... Because it's not as though the fact that Bante had sexual relationships was a deadly secret. It wasn't, but something about the times and the letter and the way he wrote it, and him, he's a nice, great guy. It was like a kind of catalyst or a depth charge or something. It just seemed to kind of go into the heart of the community and just stir everything up. So there's a lot of turbulence and turmoil and unhappiness and anger and upset, and actually also a lot of creativity, really. So it was a very interesting period to reflect on. But it was also quite difficult running a retreat centre, coming on retreats, not being sure about being ordained anymore, and, you know, all that kind of stuff, and just kind of trying to be open to all that. So at the end of that year, I was very tired, and I went on a holiday, and I came back and I thought I had a kind of bit of a virus, and actually I had pneumonia somehow. I contracted pneumonia, and I was much iller than I thought I was. And we were in the middle at Tiruvannamalai of restructuring everything. We were in the middle of kind of, let's open it all up, let's do something really different. And that takes time and energy. And I didn't really take the convalescent time that I needed, and that's my responsibility. So I had quite a difficult year health-wise in 2004. And then I planned in 2006 anyway. I thought, when I was in my 60th year, I've been in this project for a long time, 15 years, I'll take a sabbatical. So I'd already had that in mind and being talked about. And then I realised that wasn't going to work. It wasn't going to work to take 6 months and know that my life was then programmed after that 6 months, because life in a retreat centre, you program it, you know, 18 months in advance. So I just thought, I'm going to have to leave. And it wasn't what I thought. You know, I thought I was going to be there a long time, but I thought that through quite a lot, and then thought, yeah, no, I do. I just really need to leave and have a break and just see what happens. So take a longer sabbatical. So I left here at the local at the end of 2005 and moved back to London. Some people thought that was odd. I'd lived in the country for a long time, and actually I'm quite a city girl. And I lived very quietly with a friend down the Roman Road, not close to the centre, but not too close. And about 18 months, I did very, very little. I sat on my sofa, looked out the window, and I had a bath, and, you know, rested and went to cinemas and art galleries when I was well enough, and met friends. I got a lot of friends here. So I had a very quiet, restorative, reflective, mulling over kind of time. It was very, very restorative, very helpful. And one of the things I realised in my mullings, I don't think I call it reflecting necessarily, is I thought, oh, there's a sort of pattern to my life, isn't there? It's like the first 12 years, I'm kind of really intensely involved. And then I go, I think I need a change. I think I need a bit more space in my life. You know, take some space. And then I think, and then I get involved in another project that's longer and even more intensely involved. And I go, I think I need a space. So I could see there's a sort of pattern, and you know, who knows whether I do another project or not. I don't know. So yes, I live a quietish life. After about 18 months, I began to sort of pick up responsibilities, do things that I wanted to do, but the things that I do now are done within a much more spacious life than the life I lived at Tivatna Loka. That worked then, this works now, and I'm older, and I really enjoy time on my own and sitting on the sofa looking out the window. Very important stage of life. So yeah, that's my life at the moment. So I'll say some things just in conclusion. So looking back over, you know, my spiritual life, I started off, you know, very inspired by the Bodhisattva idea, and that still is a big inspiration for me. I still believe that we as a community, if we engage intensively with each other in whatever way we do that and create harmony amongst us, I believe we can be a kind of, you know, vehicle, conduit for that, you know, non-egoic stream of spiritual energy to arise within us. And we do it. It happens anyway. We create harmony, and something other comes into being, doesn't we? Touch into that in many, many situations. So I still believe in that ideal. And we're not perfect. I'm not perfect. No one's perfect. The movement isn't perfect. We've all got lots of faults. So in a way, that's part of it, isn't it? It's part of the process that we're engaged with, is to work with what stands in our way, kind of that light shining through individually and collectively. So let's kind of get in there. And I remember Sangharakshana many years ago standing here. I think he was probably summing up a talk, and he said, you know, the movement isn't perfect. It's got faults. It's got faults from the bottom to the top, from the top to the bottom. And it doesn't help to stand on the edges and criticise. Just get in there and help to, you know, change those faults, make things better. I'm still very connected with the figure of Green Tara. She's still a great inspiration for me, but I do other practices as well, and that's happened particularly in the last 10 years. It's very, very interesting that I was with my mother when she died, and it was almost from that moment that she took her last breath, and the next day, you know, what unfolded from there, I couldn't do that kind of practice. I couldn't seem to do that kind of contemplation of a Buddha or Bodhisattva visualization. I just couldn't do it, which was a bit of a loss, because she'd been being tarred in such a sort of spiritual companion. I could only just sit, you know, just sit and try and be aware. And that continued for quite a long time. It was as though a kind of door closed, very mysterious. And so I began to do other kinds of practice, particularly reflections. So I very much enjoy the four mind-turning reflections, which reflecting on the precious human birth. and reflecting on impermanence and death, particularly those two. I really like to reflect on death. I find that sobering, and I also find it very exhilarating. And I do bodhicitta practice. And I've rediscovered the mindfulness of breathing, a practice that I've never really got on with. I seem to be able to do it these days. I think it's because I'm so much less willful than I used to be. And then 2007-ish, I think I was on a retreat, and someone asked me to lead a green Tara puja. I thought, well, I can do that. She's still on my shrine. I still got a connection. I don't contemplate her every day, but yeah, I'll lead the puja. And it had an enormous effect on me, as though I reconnected incredibly strongly, as though that door then reopened. So the mind is very mysterious. So she's still very much part of my life. Yes, I feel fortunate also in my Dharma life to have so many good friends. You know, I've got friends that go back almost 40 years. The guy I was married to that I came along with is an ordinary, and I'm still very good friends with him. We've been married for many, many years, so I've known him the longest. And people I met on that first retreat are still my friends. And I'm, you know, making new friends, but there's something about long-term friendships, those of you who've got long-term friendships, that is very, very important. People who just know you so well, they know your history, they know everything about you. That's fantastic. So that's a real gift, I think. And I think that for any of us, friendship, well, for me it's often been a sort of rock bottom and things are kind of falling to bits. If I've got some friends I can talk to, if I've got two or three friends that I can say absolutely anything to, I can get through anything. So make friends. It's really, really important for your spiritual life. Yeah, so that's been very important. And then Sangharakshita once said of the spiritual life that you could see it as having, it's almost like there are four disciples or four kinds of experiences of the spiritual path. So for some people it's easy all the way through. For some people it's easy at the beginning and hard at the end. For some people it's hard at the beginning and easy at the end. That must be hard. And for some people it's hard all the way through. You were hoping I wasn't going to say that, weren't you? And he said it doesn't matter. You know, you just have to practice. You know, for some people there may be all kinds of difficulties, but you just keep practicing. And he also said on a different occasion, if you know, you're practicing and you're still finding life hard, maybe you're just a novice bodhisattva having an off life. Don't make too much of a big deal about it. The next one might be better. He's got a great sense of humour. But, you know, back in those days when I was struggling with all those mental states, I thought, well, it's obvious, isn't it? It's number four. It's going to be hard all the way through. I mean, that's how it is, and I just have to keep going. But actually, that's not the case. Somewhere along the line, that changed. I mean, it changed out of, you know, intensive practice, it changed out of engaging with friendship, in all the things in one's Dharma life that one engages with, that began to change. And sometimes you don't realise those changes, except in hindsight. You kind of think, oh, you know, I haven't heard that inner critical voice for a while. Or, you know, fallen into irrational guilt, or fallen into depression, or fallen into despair, or any of those things. You know, I could sort of think, oh, that doesn't happen so much anymore. And if it did, it lasts less long and, you know, goes less deep or something. And, you know, with that, you know, a great deal more kind of happiness and joy. So my experience is, you know, it was hard at the beginning and it seems to be getting easier as time goes by. Not that life necessarily is easier, but kind of one's inner resources, like my inner life is kind of, I'm more integrated, I'm not so willful, I'm not so split, I'm happier, I look after myself better, you know, all those sort of things I found so difficult. I seem to have managed to transform to some degree. And that, you know, is due to the Dharma, that's due to coming in contact with the teachings of the Buddha, the teachings of the Buddha as communicated by Sangharakshita so brilliantly. By the meditation practices that we're taught, and you know, in relationship to the friends who've helped me so much in my life, and I'm very grateful to all of those conditions. Thank you.